from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Gavin Newsom has lamented that his workaday life as California's lieutenant governor is nothing like being the mayor of San Francisco. But the position has allowed Newsom to engage deeply with a range of state and national issues, including gun control and marijuana legalization. He'll join us to talk about state politics, the presidential race, and his bid to become the next governor of California. And we'll also talk with Gavin Newsom, who's a UC Regent, about UC Davis Chancellor Linda Catahey, who has been placed on administrative leave. Forum is up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We welcome back to Forum in this opening hour former San Francisco mayor and California lieutenant governor and gubernatorial hopeful Gavin Newsom, who joins us in the studio. And welcome back.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I say welcome back, governor, because technically lieutenant governors are called governor.
I know. It upsets a lot of folks that wish that never would happen.
You want to be called governor when you're elected governor.
That's
right?
Good. Well, and Jerry seems to be heading out of state more often than in the past. So acting governor title has been a little bit more consistent lately.
Well, no jokes about your job. I want to get into serious issues right away here. And because you are a regent and because there was news that broke just yesterday about UC President Napolitano actually putting UC Davis Chancellor Linda Catahey on paid administrative leave over her service on corporate boards and her school's hiring of consultants to improve its image. I have to ask the question about just how much President Napolitano has taken tough enough action here, particularly in light of all the sexual harassment cases. And I mean, we've certainly talked a good deal about this on the Forum program, and these are separate issues. But is she being too? She calls a task force basically when these things happen.
Yeah, we have a lot of task force right now. A couple thoughts on Jenna Napolitano. I was very enthusiastic about the search that ultimately led to her coming to the UC system, and was very vocal in that support when we hired her. She hit the ground running. It's rather extraordinary. I mean, she came in as if she had been in the system for decades. She is not an insignificant leader. She is a leader personified, and she has got grit and determination, and she's got a vision, and she has exercised that vision, that grit and determination in the first year, year and a half she's been in office. She has been challenged, however, quite notably by a series of issues, sexual harassment issues at the UC system writ large, but notably at UC Berkeley, issues associated with budget cuts and tuition increases and faculty issues. And of course, now the challenges at UC Davis.
Let me just cut to the chase, though, on UC Davis, though. Is that really enough?
No, I think it's pretty obvious what's going to happen at UC Davis. The chancellor is now on some form of leave. We're going to have a discussion in closed session at the next UC Regents meeting. I think her days are numbered. It's pretty self-evident to anyone that's paying attention to it. This has been a frustration for a lot of folks that have tried to be respectful publicly. Privately, I can assure you there's been a lot of conversations back and forth among some regents and the administration and the Office of President because of the series of issues you mentioned. And by the way, you mentioned just a few. We can go back to the pepper spray incident. We can go back to other issues, not just the boards, but other issues that have been performance-based concerns. So look, we're going to deal with that. The sexual harassment issues we're beginning to address in a more substantive and forceful way. We finally saw some accountability. Finally, we saw some folks that were let go. We have convened some work groups that actually have come out with recommendations. We're implementing the recommendations. Some still remain outstanding. But no, there's one thing that's self-evident to anybody. There's been so many issues, so much incoming, and there have been so many organized efforts to address them that leave some people wanting, meaning better to make the tough decisions rather than putting them off by processing those decisions by convening yet another work group or another task force. And so if there's any critique, and I'm a fan of Janet Napolitano's, is I think we're at a point where we've convened enough groups We should just now make the tough decisions and move forward. And I think people are getting increasingly frustrated by what's going on at the system largely. And frankly, it's getting in the way of the conversation we need to have, which is what's a 21st century higher education system look like? What world are we living in? And what's the fate and future of the UC system, the CSU system, and the community college system in a world of declining resources in terms of public support, in a world where we don't want to see tuition continue to increase and debt burdens continue to be extended, and in a world where people are frustrated that a degree is no longer a proxy for a job.
Let me just ask a couple more things about UC, because I want to get – you've got a gun measure here that's in the hopper, and I know listeners are going to – safety for all listeners are going to want to hear about this, a way to really circumvent all the influence of the NRA. And we've been talking about legalization of marijuana, and you've got some announcements to make. But
yeah,
let me just stay with UC for the moment here. Should Chancellor Dirks be replaced?
I'm a supporter of his. I meet with him consistently. He's had a tough job. He's battling a $150 million budget deficit. It is serious. UC Berkeley in particular is struggling as much or more than any other campus in our UC system. And it is it's like a Fabergé egg. It is absolutely precious. And we must maintain its status as a world-class institution of higher learning. And he is finally making the tough choices. And frankly, structurally, those choices were not being made, those tough choices in the past. So he's inherited, like Janet Napolitano, I think, a difficult hand.
Talking again with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and what about – I mean, you were talking for a while about calling for higher standards for UC athletes. You were also talking about admission standards to allow, for example, computer science to be – for high school students
in lieu of
math courses. I mean, are you still pushing these kinds of things?
100%. In fact, we're going to be making announcements on new athletic contracts at the UC system. We've been working on this the last 6 months. As some folks may or may not know, UC Berkeley had the lowest graduation rate of all Division I football programs in the nation. They were one of the worst on the football field and one of the lowest graduation rates in the nation. That's just unacceptable. And with all due respect, as someone that got into college, I literally would not have gotten into college had it not been for baseball. And so I am blessed by college athletics. What we do to college athletes is disgraceful, particularly to African-American athletes. And the fact that UC Berkeley, one of the finest institutions of higher learning in the world, cannot graduate even 50% a few years ago of their athletes is unacceptable, particularly in contrast to places like Duke and Stanford that are graduating 95%+ of their athletes. And so we've got to change our mindset. We've got to change our values. We've got to change the culture. And we're working closely with the campus to do that. And we'll be making some very specific and prescriptive announcements to be more accountable to academic achievement, not just athletic achievement. As it relates to computer science, we have 86,000+ job openings for computer science graduates in this state. Yet we're only graduating about 3,500. And of those, 15% are women. If that's not code red, talking about coding, I don't know what else is. Those stats are self-evidently problematic. And one of the things we believe we can do is require that the UC system, through its admission process, accept computer science as one of its core curriculum requirements for application, meaning we have a process called A through G. You've got to get through these A through G courses, mathematics being one of them, in order to get to the UC or CSU system. Places like Texas have allowed computer science to replace as one of those core curriculum mathematics. California hasn't. This is one area where we think we can accelerate the number of graduates by increasing the number of opportunities for youth in our high school system by changing that requirement. We're working hard to do that, and I'm running with intense resistance from faculty, but we're going to, I think, ultimately prevail.
Talk about prevailing. I do want to talk with you about marijuana and about gun control. But before we get there, let me just ask you, because we were yesterday in Sonoma. We did a live broadcast from Roanoke Park, Sonoma State, and there was a lot of talk in the second hour of the program about if indeed Hillary Clinton is now going to be the nominee and Bernie Sanders has already let about 100 people go, and it looks as if in terms of delegates, I don't want to say it's fait accompli, he says he's going right to the end and so
sure.
forth, but it certainly doesn't look that good for him, and I know many people are sad about that. And you're a Clinton supporter, I believe.
Yeah, longtime Clinton supporter. Right. And and a supporter of Bernie Sanders, but I am a Clinton supporter for President of the United States.
So what do you do about, and this was a central question yesterday when we were up at Sonoma with all these young people, what do you do about all this energy there? About 70% of the students there, 75% are Sanders supporters. And, you know, a lot of them, these millennials are saying, he's our candidate, and if we don't like Hillary Clinton, we don't trust Hillary Clinton, and now that Bernie's out of the fray, we don't want to be part of the Hillary Clinton administration or even vote for her.
I just feel like I've seen this movie before. I remember we were saying the same thing. Hillary folks were never going to vote for Obama. And boy, that seems, I mean, you know, you can't even convince folks that was the case because we were enthusiastically supportive of Obama in that 2008 campaign.
It's a very different case, though, in terms of demographics.
It is always different. There's unique circumstances, certainly the millennial side of this. But at the end of the day, there's one uniting thing here that's self-evident, and that is the likelihood of Donald Trump being the nominee of the Republican Party. I don't think we're going to have to work too hard to unite the Democrats in opposition of the likely and presumptive Republican nominee.
Well, we've already seen Ted Cruz name a running mate, Carly Fiorina. You said on Bravo television that Caitlyn Jenner might be Trump's running mate?
Yeah, well, you're having fun when you're on Bravo television. It's interesting to me. I've known Carly for years. When I was mayor, we reached out to her when we were trying to secure the Olympics for the region. I met her at the World Economic Forum a number of times, and I've actually was on Meet the Press with her, and I feel like we're still debating because off the air she kept going and going and going. I'm not a big fan of hers. I admire her grit. I admire her intellect, but I don't admire her tenure at HP. I don't admire her politics, and I think it was a desperate effort by Ted Cruz to maintain some relevancy in a campaign.
Well, to get media
over.
Spotlight, too.
This thing barely lasted 12-hour story. It was rather a feat effort, and it's sort of embarrassing in many respects.
Think he's going to take Indiana, though? I mean,
if he does, it's
not going to vault him
this.
If he does.
No, I mean, it's every week. This is the most important. If we win, and then he tends to lose and lose another race. Look, California will matter because it's the biggest state and most delegates, and we're going to get what the rest of the country has enjoyed, and that's the opportunity to watch all these campaign commercials.
Imagine,
for
California
months.
Finally matters.
We matter.
In the primary. we could talk politics some more, but I want to get right to this effort that you put forward here, Safety for All, and talk about it, and talk about the idea of really doing something, finally, about gun control.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, California has the opportunity this November. Tomorrow, we're going to announce that we've secured 600,000 signatures to place on the ballot an initiative to pass the most progressive gun safety measures in the history of the United States. And I know that's a bold statement, but we have the opportunity to do something no other state in the country has done. And I'll give you just one of the six examples that are in this initiative. And that is to treat ammunition like we treat guns. We have background checks in this country for guns. Most of us embrace that. And most of us understand the effectiveness of that, particularly in a country where we've rejected close to 2.6 million people that have tried through the Brady background checks to gain guns, but were on the prohibited purchasers list. Ammunition, we don't go through that same background check. Currently in California, anyone can sell ammunition. Your child care center can sell ammunition. Your daycare center can sell ammunition. The corner grocery store can sell ammunition. There's no licensing requirements. You can buy unlimited caches of ammunition online. You can have them delivered to your home. What's interesting to me is some people will embrace the notion of background checks on guns, which in and of itself, a gun is not dangerous unless it's used as a blunt instrument. It's dangerous for one reason. It's the ammunition that's attached to it and then dislodged from it. We believe we should treat ammunition like we do guns. You have to use your license to get Sudafed, but you have no obligations to get unlimited caches of ammunition. California can lead the nation this November through our Safety for All Act to do just that. And that's just one, again, of six provisions that will put California on the map and change the dialogue from one of sort of frustration and angst to, I think, a very optimistic outlook that at a bottom-up level, state by state, we could tackle this issue, we could turn this around, and we could take on the NRA and we could beat them, not on their home court, the legislative branches, but through direct democracy.
Well, you work with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence on this, which came about in 1993 after the tragedy at 101 California. But to my surprise, to some extent, you've been getting criticism, not from the NRA, but from some people who feel that some of these other parts of this proposal. There was a guy, in fact, Adam Winkler, who wrote a UCLA law prof. I don't know if you saw it.
I was surprised by that, candidly. Yeah, no, it's interesting. You know, it's, you know, this is very analogous. It's fascinating.
By the way, NRA calls it safety for none. They cite opposition to the California State Sheriff's Association that maintained that it would put peaceful citizens on the wrong side of the law without curbing violent crime.
Yeah, they've been opposed to all gun safety measures. Now, in California, since 1993, we've seen a 56. You use 93 as an example. Since the 101 tragic shooting in California, in San Francisco, 1993, when we got aggressive on our gun safety measures, we had one of the highest crime rates in the United States of America back then. Over 5,000 people were killed by gun violence in 1993. We've seen a 56% decline in gun violence in this state, which is substantially greater reduction than the rest of the nation. As we've led the nation in background check legislation, assault rifle legislation, our own system that is in place for a quarter of a century to allow us a more robust background check system than even the federal system itself. California has led, and we have reduced gun violence as a consequence. And in every single instance, the NRA has opposed those efforts. And in every analysis since, they've been proven wrong over and over and over again. The next great effort on gun safety is going to be around ammunition. And California has the chance to lead. And this is scaring the heck out of the NRA. And you know what I say? Good. It's time to take these guys on. I'm sick and tired of the National Rifle Association, sick and tired of the threats. And with all due respect to a lot of my Democratic colleagues, they're threatened as much as Republicans are threatened from doing the right thing. And that's why the five key provisions, there's six, but five key provisions that I have in the Safety for All initiative have been watered down or killed in the California legislature in the past just few years. So the NRA even has influence in California. You can imagine the influence they exercise in some of those deeper, darker red states across the country.
Well, the issue that this law professor, Adam Winkler, particularly seemed to be focused on was the issue of magazines. And he seemed to feel you're grandfathering in magazines. He cited Sunnyvale as a failure, for example.
Yeah, okay. A pretty desperate attempt to cite Sunnyvale as a failure. Sunnyvale was the first municipality in the state of California to ban the possession of large capacity magazine clips. What these are, in essence, there's large capacity clips that were used, for example, in the Gabby Gifford tragedy. 30 rounds were used in 15 seconds. 30 shots were fired in just 15 seconds. And half of all the mass shootings in this country in the last few decades, these are the large capacity clips that are used. We already have a ban in the state of California on the sale and manufacturing of large capacity clips, but not the possession. Sunnyvale was the first, San Francisco the second, LA County the third, and recently, because of leadership of Libby Schaft, Oakland. So you already have a patchwork. You also have a number of other states that have a magazine ban possession in place. It works.
I think it's in 11 states.
Yeah, 11 states. We would be the 12th. And so I don't know why, you know, we could pick these things apart, but it seems to make some good sense from my perspective. If you can't sell them and you can't manufacture them, they're used in these mass shootings. They service no real benefit if you're deer hunting. My gosh, you need 11 rounds or more? Come on. That's absurd. These are mass killing machines. That's all they are, that we follow the lead of those 11 other states. So with respect to a professor of whatever he is, I respectfully disagree.
So you've got a lieutenant governor leading the charge in terms of gun control and also legalization of marijuana. A Blue Ribbon Panel has been formed.
Well, Blue Ribbon Panel, we spent 2 years analyzing best practices in Washington State and Colorado. As you know, Oregon and Alaska have moved forward in D.C. With legalization of marijuana. It's time for California to lead again on this, as we did in 1996 with the first state to advance legalization of medical marijuana. California is the largest market marijuana. marijuana in the nation, largest producer and exporter of marijuana, this is a game changer. It's not only going to change the debate nationally as it relates to legalization of marijuana, but it's going to have a profound impact in Mexico.
Let's talk about what it is. I mean, substantively, what we're talking about here, because I know you've been on record as saying you're really concerned about keeping kids away from use of marijuana, about helping addicts and so forth. So you got a whole package.
Yeah, I'm the most unlikely proponent of legalization. That's why I chaired this task force, because my sense was I was looking around and I was wondering, where's the leadership on this issue in the state of California, in Sacramento? And frankly, people are still running away from it. I'm the only statewide Democrat that's supporting legalization. And frankly, I don't know the position of any of the others. And it's not an indictment of the individuals. It's an indictment of the system that doesn't incentivize a very vocal position on this issue, because it's tough. Anything to do with criminal justice is tough. I was the only one who supported Prop 47, only one who supported the repeal of the death penalty, only one that supported the change in the three strikes law, only one that publicly supported those positions, because these are tough political stances to have. That said, I feel a sense of responsibility and accountability that we have a system that disproportionately burdens poor people, disproportionately burdens people of color. And I find it repugnant. I think the war on drugs is an abject failure. And I don't want that as a rhetorical applause line. I need to follow that up substantively. And that's why I chair this task force. But as a parent, I don't like the drug. I don't like the smell. I don't want people driving under the influence. I don't want to encourage my kids to use it. I don't want big tobacco to become big marijuana. And I'm concerned about it.
You did a whole program on it recently, because there's this exhibit at Oakland, the Oakland Museum, about the history and about the effects and about policy and so forth.
And I don't think it's a benign drug for kids.
For teenagers especially, I was talking about how the brain is not even formed yet.
Yeah, and I think those are real concerns. And those that dismiss that are wrong. But the point was, a lot of folks were dismissing that, and they were for free-for-all, a free enterprise on marijuana. I said, no, hold on. I'm not going to support any initiative. And so we put together a series of recommendations, a Blue Ribbon Task Force, and we said, here are the parameters. And we worked with one group in particular, and we are now out getting signatures. And I won't give the exact date, but we're within days of being able to make an announcement that we will be placing on the ballot the opportunity for the voters to decide for themselves if they want to tax and regulate marijuana for adult use in the state of California this November.
Also, talking about shutting down Diablo Canyon?
Well, we have one remaining nuclear power plant in the state of California. And I'll tell you, if you gave me the top five worst locations to place a nuclear power plant, that would be on the current site of the nuclear power plant near San Luis Obispo, which we have discovered just recently four fault lines near and around this nuclear power plant.
And PG&E wants a new lease.
Well, PG&E has expressed publicly a desire to extend the lease past their 2025. They have a number of leases that come up. There's two significant leases, 2024, 2025, and then one no one paid attention to. And this is why I get into the middle of it. I, every other year, chair State Lands. State Lands has an obligation to consider an extension of an easement that expires well before the 2024-2025 deadline. We are looking at that issue very closely because of all this new information that has come to light as it relates to seismic safety of the facility and all the new rules and regulations that have been in place as it relates to, and I won't burden folks with technicalities, one through cooling systems and all these emission-related standards. And we're taking a good look at this, and we are asking the question, what's the world look like without nuclear energy, and can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions and maintain low prices in a stable energy mix?
But of course, then you get into the whole debate about climate change and the concern about needing to have nuclear energy.
And when we come back, let's talk specifically.
All right, we will. But also, I want to invite our listeners to join us with Gavin Newsom, talking about a lot of things here, a whole range of topics, but particularly about marijuana, gun control, national politics, and now Diablo Canyon. You can join NUC. Join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's the toll-free number to call if you'd like to join the program now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, presently lieutenant governor of California, and declared candidate for governor once Jerry Brown abdicates. And we're talking about a whole range of issues. And in fact, we certainly would welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I'm going to go right to your calls and emails forthwith. But before we do, we were talking before we went on to the break about shutting down Diablo Canyon. Is it unsafe? And it's clear that Governor Newsom, that is, by the way, the correct designation, is in favor of that, and there are going to be environmental impact reports. We get 8% now. You know, that may not be significant, but in terms of climate change, it's nuclear power. It's not presenting a carbon footprint, and so a lot of people say we have to preserve it.
Yeah, I'm not ideologically opposed to nuclear, quite the contrary. I just have some specific questions about this site, and one of the three remaining issues, there are three remaining issues. One you brought up, which is the issue of, all right, if you're going to shut this thing down, God forbid we shut it down and then have to go out and purchase coal producing energy in California and increase our greenhouse gas emissions, or do what we did with San Onofre when we closed it down abruptly, and that was increase our greenhouse gas emissions by purchasing natural gas. And so we want to have this conversation now so that we can avoid making bad decisions and really talk about a mix of electrical portfolio that actually can be consistent with our values and with our core tenets that we have established with our low carbon green growth strategies in California. I believe we can get there, but we have an obligation to prove that before we assert that this needs to be shut down by a certain date. But there's two other components, and that is, this is a big job creator. There are a lot of real people that are actually well-paid folks that have been working at this plant for years, and their jobs matter, and we need to value that workforce, and we need to maintain that workforce and provide off-ramps and opportunities if this thing is shuttered. And third, it has a huge economic benefit and stimulus for the local communities. And if we're going to shut this plant down, we're going to have to deal with that as well. So those are three issues that we must address. And that's why we're trying to have this conversation today, in contrast to the conversations that were not held as it relates to the last power plant, nuclear power plant that was shut down, San Onofre in the state of California.
Okay, I want to get to calls. Let me just give a little pushback here from listeners. This is a listener who says, Newsom seems to shy away from core economic issues that affect most people's takes on social issues. I want an economic liberal who will fight for people like me. We need a real liberal, not just a social liberal.
I don't get that, because I chair the Economic Development Commission and put out a very comprehensive economic development plan for the state. And its core tenet is this: growth and inclusion. I'm a small business person. I have 21 small businesses, close to 1,000 people I employ in the state of California. This is not an academic exercise, economic development and growth for me. There's probably no statewide official that talks more about economic development than I do. The notion that we live in two different worlds in the same state, two different worlds in the same cities, the 94123 zip code in the Marina District in San Francisco versus the 94124 zip code in Bayview Hunters Point, East Palo Alto, West Palo Alto, East Oakland, Oakland Hills. And so my focus is growth and inclusion, a detailed economic development strategy, and mind the gap as it relates to the extraordinary number of people living in poverty in this state, and creating a framework where California becomes the essential startup state in this nation. And I think we can do a lot more. And frankly, I think there's been a lack of intentionality around economic development in this state, and we hope to address that in a substantive way.
Well, we go to our calls next, but here's somebody on the gun control initiative. This is Jake, who says, why would California groups like the Game Wardens Association, Deputy District Attorneys Association, and State Sheriffs Association all take the position of being against this ballot?
Because they've consistently been opposed to gun safety measures for decades. It's, you know, it was about as predictable as the day is long, sunrise, sunset, that the sheriffs would send out a letter opposing. In fact, I hope people take a look. We should publish a letter. It was a pretty benign letter of opposition. They, in essence, said, well, we don't think it will make much of a difference. I beg to disagree, and I'll give you a very specific example. In 2008, in the city of Sacramento, they decided to track ammunition sale, and they discovered 156 people were buying ammunition, even though they were on the prohibited purchasers list and could not legally own a gun. So they decided to knock on the doors and say, why are you buying ammunition, sir, if you can't buy, you can't own a gun? And they discovered that folks had guns illegally in their possession, including assault rifles. They were able to process 109 felony counts against those folks. That's a small city, one small example. With a registry on ammunition, this provides, I think, a real opportunity to get guns off the streets that are in the hand of people that cannot and should not have them, and address the issue of violence in a very meaningful and substantive way.
Again, we're talking to Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of California, and we go to Jack in Davis. Jack, you're our first caller up. Welcome.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I would hope that Mr. Newsom would take recommendations from Governor Brown, the Pope, Bernie Sanders, rather than listening to the big rollers and money movers. I'm a supporter of Mr. Newsom, but I really want you to kind of make sure that, you know, the regular everyday people have a sense of that the leaders are living the same lives as they are.
No, I appreciate that. And I just, you know, so you're aware and your listeners are aware. You know, it's interesting. I have a very prescriptive proposal to provide free community college in the state of California. And by the way, the price tag to provide free community college in the state of California for all matriculating high school students is not as staggering as some may believe. It's not insignificant, but it's roughly $250 million. That's in line with Bernie Sanders' very aggressive pronouncements on the same topic. I was out front with one other statewide official supporting the ballot initiatives to get us to the $15 minimum wage, and very grateful that Governor Brown was able to negotiate a compromise that achieves that goal in the next few years. I have come out publicly in support of single payer. I don't know many Democrats that publicly are supportive of single payer.
No, Senator Sanders is.
Sanders, and I align with the caller's context that I've been very out front and very progressive on these issues. So I appreciate the sentiment of your comments, and I want you to know, just rest assured, I'll maintain my status of standing out front on issues like legalization, standing out front of criminal justice reform, which to me is economic reform, is much more than anything else, to look at the issue of bail, money bail in the state. We need to talk more about money bail. Why do we have it? Why are we one of two countries in the world that has a money bail system, which hurts poor people and keeps them incarcerated, costs the taxpayers money, and does not reduce crime or create deterrence? These are issues that I care about. These are progressive issues. But at the same time, as the previous caller noted, I am a pro-growth Democrat, and I am a pro-job Democrat. And I say pro-job in this context. You cannot be pro-job and anti-business. And I think this is something my party needs to appreciate. It's not about large corporate multinationals, but it's about embracing entrepreneurialism, embracing small businesses, and embracing the notion that we're all in this together, growth and inclusion.
And we'll include another caller here. Join us, Ray. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a question for our guest. I just basically want to know if he's not only for the legalization of marijuana, but also for civil rights attached to that freedom. Basically, right now, with the medical use in California, there are no civil rights. You could get fired from a job for testing positive for marijuana, even though you are doing it in your free time and for medical purposes.
Yeah, well, we, in fact, in partnership with the ACLU, we put out our Blue Ribbon Task Force. And I would encourage you to go online to our safetyforall.com website, and you can read and download that task force report that goes into very prescriptive detail. One of the preeminent concerns that not just the caller has, but members of our task force, including my partner, the ACLU, has on just that issue. And you'll see the recommendations that we're making that will not only be addressed in the initiative, which you'll have a chance very shortly to vote on, but also through the application and implementation if the voters support it. And I want to just say this very briefly.
Let me just ask you quickly, though. What about the sale of marijuana for, say, paying the community college tab that you're talking about, or other public issues that can be supported with revenue?
I don't want it to be a gold rush for California, and I don't support marijuana because of the taxes it generates, the legalization. I support it for social justice issues. I support it for moral and ethical issues. I support it because we need to send a message to the rest of the country about this war on drugs. But it will generate millions, hundreds, billions of dollars of tax revenue, which we have in the initiative targeted to go back to invest in prevention programs, treatment programs, and youth development programs and education-related programs. So it will have that residual benefit quite specifically. But I point what I want to make to everybody. Legalization is not a single-day event that will occur in November of 2016 in California. It's a process that will unfold over years and years and years. And the caller's point was precisely right. We have to be flexible. We have to be open to argument, interested in evidence. And in the application of our rules, in the applications of the new realities of a legalized regime, we have to be very sensitive to the intended and unintended consequences. What's happened in Washington State and Colorado was not necessarily in every instance what they intended. And some of the problems they had in their legalization efforts was their legalization efforts was too prescriptive. And it basically shackled their ability to be more flexible and has slowed down some of their reforms.
There's another big problem here, though.
We want to be flexible. We want to be very, very open to argument as it relates to the changing nature of the process as it unfolds.
Well, let me go right to that point because there's been really not enough research on cannabis, and cannabis becomes stronger as time goes on, and some of it was sprayed with Paraquat, and you have all of that that has to be factored in. But the strength of marijuana and the potency of it is something, because of its illegality, that hasn't been researched.
No.
And we need that kind of research to move forward.
It's been the great vexing frustration. I mean, just an abomination. It's still a Schedule I drug in the United States. And as a consequence, we can't legally do the kind of analysis. Now, there has been some analysis, but it's under regimes that make it very difficult to share the data and information and to really feel confident that the research can translate in any meaningful way. We, in our initiative, actually set aside money specifically for research, investing in the UC system, which is the finest institution of research, not just institution of higher learning in the United States.
A Fabergé egg.
A Fabergé egg that must be maintained at all costs.
Never heard it compared to a Fabergé egg.
Maybe it's a bad example.
That's a different metaphor. Let me get some more callers on. We'll go to Scott in Los Gatos. Scott, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Michael, I really appreciate your show. It's really awesome.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor Newsom, David Brooks, and other people have talked about the importance of pre- and postnatal care. And how important early childhood development is to breaking the cycle of poverty. I hear you talk about things have already been established policy-wise. The Supreme Court's ruled about Second Amendment. These are bureaucratic concerns in terms of keeping an eye on how people are buying ammunition. I'd like to know what you're doing to actually end the cycle of poverty with children.
I love it. God is my witness. I'm sitting here. My fists are raised. My hands are raised in enthusiastic embrace of your question. I was just in New York, got back late last night. I was meeting day before yesterday with Nick Kristof, who's also written extensively about early childhood education, but notably 0 to 18 months. My focus, and I am going to be putting out a very detailed, comprehensive policy paper, is on prenatal care. I think the issue of poverty, our interventions come too late. And while in San Francisco, when I was proud to be mayor, we fully implemented universal preschool, and I am a very vocal supporter to increase our preschool slots and extend our child care opportunities in the state of California, I believe similarly our interventions come too late. About half the births in this country are Medicaid births. Translating California, about half the births are Medi-Cal births. We have points of intervention. And if we can really focus our interventions prenatally, we can have a profound impact on reforming our K-12 education system by preventing the kind of triage that we are experiencing, even in preschool, which oftentimes those interventions come even then too late. So this is an area of passion. As a father of four young kids, six, seven-week-old, a two-year-old, a four-year-old, a six-year-old, it is at home with me 24 hours a day.
What are your kids' names?
Some interesting names. Dutch is my new child's name, Brooklyn, Hunter, and Montana. The NRA should embrace those, right? Montana and Hunter. You would think they would come to my defense.
Well, speaking of the NRA, let me thank the caller and go to a comment from Enrique. And this is the sort of comment I'm sure you're hearing and will hear more of as this comes on the ballot. Enrique writes, "This man has the nerve to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and work to infringe the Second Amendment? What a hypocrite. The NRA is people like me, hunters, target shooters, etc., people who live in areas where self-defense is critical."
Yeah, who's taking your gun? I mean, what are you talking about? With all due respect, I hope you take time to read the initiative. What, in fact, every provision in the initiative, we're confident, maintains its constitutional scrutiny. I'll give you an example. In San Francisco, that we just were affirmed, the magazine possession ban was just affirmed by the federal courts as constitutional. Even Scalia, the hero of the far right and a lot of the folks in the NRA, made the point that the Second Amendment's not unlimited. And so reasonable constraints are put into place. Background checks seems to be one of them. It belies common sense that anyone would think someone who's dangerously mentally ill or is a felon should have unfettered access to unlimited amounts of caches of ammunition and weapons. Why is it so offensive to simply go through a background check? You need to do that again to get Sudafed in this country. And I hardly think it's an assault on your constitutional rights.
Well, we're going to go to more of your phone calls here. I want to go to a couple of tweets, though. One is on the presidential race. One is on Ed Lee. And Sherry writes on the presidential race, I respectfully disagree with Gavin Newsom. Many Bernie Sanders supporters agree that Hillary Clinton will throw us under the bus for money.
Yeah, look, I appreciate that sentiment. I'm not denying that sentiment. But I have great confidence in Bernie supporters. And trust me, I'm surrounded by them, that at the end of the day, this party is going to unite. At the end of the day, our values are so much more aligned than the values of our opponents, at least those in the Republican Party. And the stakes couldn't be more clear. And the stake that is crystal clear.
You mentioned Trump. He used to be a Democrat. He used to be pro-choice. He used to be on board with progressive politics.
Who knows what the heck you get hour to hour, not just day to day, month to month. But one of the critical issues of our time is self-evident in the context of this entire hour's conversation. And that's the Supreme Court. Do you want, and this is my question to all the Bernie Sanders supporters, do you want to sit on the sidelines and trust to fate the prospect you're going to have Donald Trump determining with a Republican-dominated Congress the fate and future of Roe v. Wade, the fate and future of our country as it relates to unlimited, unfettered spending, the number one issue that defines the unity around the Bernie Sanders supporters, money and politics, which I agree with 100%, to a Republican appointment of a Supreme Court justice. That in and of itself should enliven the senses of every like-minded Democrat to unite around Hillary Clinton this November.
Here's a tweet from Zev. Let's get local for a moment. What's your assessment of Ed Lee's progress on creating affordable housing in San Francisco?
Nothing worse than an ex-mayor answering questions about current mayors. It drove me crazy when Willie had that column. Just my luck. I become mayor and Willie Brown gets his own column talking about the good old days 3 weeks ago when I was mayor and there was the skies were blue. And I'm a Willie fan. But I'm a big supporter of Ed Lee. His administration I think, done a very good job under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And ironically, those circumstances are almost unique in the nation. And that is success. They're victims of extraordinary success, which is putting pressure on everything in this city. And, of course, the raging debates of gentrification, affordability as it relates to not just housing, but affordability for commercial establishments and small businesses and the like. And so I think he's done a very good job under difficult circumstances. I know it's easy to take pot shots. I know that better than anybody because I've been there. But I'm a fan and I'm a supporter.
Are you a fan and supporter of Greg Sir? I'm calling for his resignation, Chief Sir?
Yeah, I've
Chief
known
Police of San Francisco.
I've known Greg for years. I just was talking. I was robbed the other day. My card. The chief was kind enough to call me. I know everyone's saying, "Well, he didn't call me." No, there was no gun in the car, but there was an iPad that, by the way, was sold within 15 minutes. It's quite a racket we have in the city as it relates to these petty crimes, which is an issue, by the way, going up and up. And I experienced it firsthand last week. That said, no, look, this department, and I'm very supportive of the rank and file in this department. There's a lot of issues with these text messages, a lot of issues with that tragedy in Bayview Hunters Point with Woods. There's a lot of questions about cameras, body cameras, and of course these alternative strategies to escalation as it relates to the use of weapons and whether or not we should have these stun guns and the like. And I want to be supportive of the administration and Greg and the district attorney's office as they address these issues in real time. But it's a very difficult moment as it relates to policing and public safety in the city, and I'm not naive to any of it.
Go to more of your calls. Jordan, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I'm looking at asking for a policy to be looked at regarding California state parks. They've had a policy of looking at now at every trip, every park trail in California for dual use with mountain bikes. Currently, a trail has been approved through Mount Tam State Park, and it's being designed now. If they would do this in Mount Tam State Park, they'll do it. They would do it anywhere. Even Humboldt Redwoods is being considered for mountain bike trails. The trails such as these would even be used by electric bikes. And they're the polar opposite of what state parks is for, destroying not only the environment and trails, but and importantly what people are looking for when they go to a state park, not to be dodging mountain bikes going down the trails. So I'm just hoping that this policy could be looked at. Carl Knapp is the state park official in charge of this program.
I love it. You know what? This is one of those wonderful moments where I am being educated in real time and taking notes. So I'll absolutely look into this as someone who lives on the base of Mount Tam. I appreciate some of the complexities of the issues, and also someone that's been quite critical of the state of our state parks in California, which are crown jewel, and they have been neglected. There's extraordinary amount of deferred maintenance, and they really are the lungs of the state. And so we want to preserve and protect them for generations. And I appreciate the issue of dual use and the lack of compatibility. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to look more into this.
And Jordan, thank you for the call. And I can attest to the fact that Governor Newsom is taking notes on this. Let me go to a question from a listener named David who says, where do we go from here to ensure water for every Californian and the ecosystems that support us?
You know, you can't legislate more rainfall. And while we've enjoyed a little bit more this year, there's no guarantee in the future. And so this remains an extraordinarily challenging issue for us. And of course, the raging debate around the Delta tunnels is just one component of this. But one thing I hope people consider as it relates to the water.
By the way, do you support the tunnel?
I'm literally in real time analyzing a position because I honestly am convinced. I mean this. It's one of those rare times. It depends who I talk to. I could be convinced by this group.
You mean you're that pliable?
No, it's not even that. It's just the arguments here. And then I meet with Lois Walk the other day and she convinces me and Congressman DeSalle that I was completely wrong. And now I'm back in the center and Jerry's folks are coming in and they're convincing me. You know, so it's just one of those vexing issues. And by the way, you know me, I have no problem taking tough stances on issues. Quite the contrary.
Are you with the governor on the train to nowhere? Or
well, that's one of the examples where I have some legitimate concerns about how we finance it. I would love to see a high-speed rail. I was the first mayor in the state to support it. But how do you finance it? The current financing package makes no sense to me because a third of that money is supposed to come from the feds, a third of the money from the private sector, and those dollars don't exist. Now, if he can figure this out, hats off to him. I'll be enthusiastically out front on it. I believe legitimately, but I am concerned about the financing. But look, the issue of water, and we don't have much time to get into the details of water right now, but I want people to think about water in this context. California as a state, while a significant role we play in water, pales in comparison to the impact 400 water agencies have on water, which represent over 85% of the water users in the state. There's a lot of autonomy, a lot of localization as it relates to water supply and recycling and all kinds of groundwater replenishment programs and independent strategies to get off the quote-unquote state system, for that matter, the California or the CVT, the Central Valley Water Project, the federal system. And so for me, it's a localized framework. It's a bottom-up, not top-down framework that I'm consumed by. And I hope folks out there listening really consider the impact of local decision-making as it relates to water security in the state and a little bit less of the focus on what's going on exclusively in Sacramento.
More of your calls for Gavin Newsom. Catherine, you're on. Morning. I'm sorry. Rebecca, you're on.
Lieutenant Governor, I was wondering if you feel that you get enough credit for being the first mayor brave enough to issue marriage certificates to gays and lesbians.
Well,
I don't think I really hear enough about that.
Mike Huckabee recently said he should be in jail like Kim Davis. Right?
Yeah, no, I finally got the warm embrace of Mike Huckabee on the Sunday shows. That's sweet of you. I sleep well at night. What we did, I thought, was the right thing to do, put a human face on the issue. And God bless everybody else that did extraordinary and heroic work since. But you know what? God bless everybody who came way before the actions we took in 2004 and the extraordinary leadership that emanated disproportionately out of San Francisco in the late 1990s on domestic partnerships, and Leslie Katz and Susan Leal and Tom Amiano and others that were extraordinarily courageous. Even Mayor Brown, people forget. I remember I just got appointed supervisor and I got a call literally from Willie who says, "Hey, you got to come to City Hall on Saturday. We're doing domestic partner ceremonies." I just got a point. I'm 26 or 7 years old, and domestic partnerships were considered extraordinary and extreme. And had those moments not occurred, then I think we wouldn't have done what we did in 2004. And of course, people like Howard Dean and others on civil unions, they all deserve extraordinary credit.
Well, you've gotten a lot of credit, though, and I think many people feel you deserve it. Are you? I get the sense, though, maybe demoralized by things in North Carolina and Mississippi.
Yeah, but it's so predictable, isn't it, that folks would be going through the religious liberty loopholes, that would be challenging things in courts, and they would go after the most vulnerable, transgenders. And let me say this with respect to the LGBT community. You know, it was very critical, by the way, a lot of the leadership of same-sex marriages when I started performing them in 2004. Some of my most vocal critics were some of the largest organizations, not NCLR and others that were champions, but some of the bigger organizations. They were also quite critical of incorporating transgender advocacy in their national agendas as well. And this is not an indictment of the national leadership. It's an indictment of a world where historically even the champions of causes sometimes fall short of manifestation, manifesting that championship. And I'm not being eloquent here. I'm just saying transgender community continues to be discriminated disproportionately in this country, and it is a disgrace what happened in these states. And I know these governors well. By the way, two of them were former mayors that were vocally opposed to same-sex marriage will ultimately prevail.
We'll have to leave it there. Always good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of the State of California. We've got another hour of Forum Ahead. We're going to meet Jeff Mano in the hour ahead, who is the author of Building Blog, and that's an architecture and design blog that was launched back in 2004. He teaches people how to, well, see the city through burglars' eyes and see architecture through burglars' eyes. Well, let's talk with Eric Ting, head of Cal Shakes, and I hope you will join us. So we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadet. Senior editor Dan Zoll and executive producer Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.